KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on what is the first show of the summer quarter on KZSU's calendar. And this is an interview, which you may have noticed already based upon the sound, that I have never done before, and a style which is similar but different, but with a guest whom I've never had on and a type of interview that I've never done. So what am I doing here? I am very excited and really honored and thrilled to have on one of the people who, as a teacher, has had a profound influence on my life, and not just mine, but indeed many people that went through the Ossining, New York public schools. Sitting in his living room in Croton, New York, I am thrilled and honored to have the opportunity today to interview my former eighth grade social studies teacher, Carl Ochsner. Now, Carl is someone who, if you were in the Ossining Public Schools or you followed history of Westchester County, you've looked at issues involving the Croton Aqueduct, which we will talk about a little bit today. You've looked at issues involving the Revolutionary War and the Hudson River. You undoubtedly have heard of. Carl was a teacher for years in the Ossining Public School, teaching social studies, but also doing far more than that. He led and still does lead, in fact, tours of local architecture, including the Croton Aqueduct. He also did a variety of classes and other pedagogical opportunities within the Annam Dorner Middle School, where I went to middle school, including the Student Rights and Responsibilities Committee, which in 1985, I and a number of other eighth graders had the honor of participating in, where Carl edited Supreme Court opinions involving issues of speech and expression, and then encouraged us to go into other classes inside Annam Dorner Middle School and explain to students what rights they had, much to the consternation of certain administrators and others in the school. Carl is a teacher who has won awards over the course of his career. He's now retired, but over the course of his career, won awards, including a runner-up Teacher of the Year in New York State in the late 80s, as well as countless other accolades. I am doing this interview like I have never done before, because for those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that I make the show about my guests, and I really try to focus on topics that I think have a wide interest within the community, not just of intellectual property and technology law people, but really are issues and topics that should be discussed more broadly in society generally. However, what I have not done, with one exception being our 200th show, where at the suggestion of listeners and even some guests, Denise Howell from This Week in Law interviewed me, I have never done a show where I've really turned to a personal influence, a personal mentor, to have that kind of discussion. But there's no one that I have had the blessing to learn from who was better suited for this kind of interview than Carl. And I am doing this straight in the sense that you don't hear a ton of emotion in my voice, but I will tell you that it's a very emotional thing for me, because as a teacher myself, I have attempted to follow the mentorship and the advice and the example of teachers and professors that I've had. And certainly while I have had a few other enormously influential professors and teachers in my life, it is fair to say that no one has had a more profound influence on my life trajectory, my love for teaching, indeed my career being a lawyer, than Carl, who put an effort into teaching which frankly, I have not yet been able to master or match, but certainly will make every effort to do so. So as much as this interview is about the listeners and about the guests, it is also, in a very real and meaningful way, a thank you to Carl for the influence he's had on me. So we are recording this show on June 20th, again, in Carl's living room here in Croton, New York. Carl, I will end the platitudes and simply say thank you for being here on the show, and thank you for joining us today to talk about your life and your work and your views on pedagogy and teaching, and also a bit about technology.
David, Well, I can say, let me first start by saying how excited I am to see you again and to tell you that you now have become one of my role models, because I am so proud of what you have accomplished and what you are doing now. It sounds like you're doing fabulously creative and interesting things and touching the lives of your students in so many ways. And so it gives me a great deal of pleasure to be here with you today. Just really thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Carl. And like I said, I think there's going to be a lot here that we can all learn from, which again is the focus here. And I think there's a lot that we can talk about. And so we can start with my basic question.
Sure.
That I ask pretty much most of my guests. I did very little on your background here, except to point out some awards and some meaningful ones. But why don't you talk a bit more about your background and how you got into teaching?
Born and raised in Ossining, parents German immigrants. Father owned a little bakery store down in downtown Ossining. My mother cleaned houses, worked in the neighborhood, etc. I was an only child, so grew up in Ossining. One of the interesting things about growing up in Ossining, which is located right on the banks of the Hudson River and has had an enormous impact on American history, especially the Native American period, the Revolutionary period, and in the 18 and early 1900s, I went through a very good school system, but never had any teachers that mentioned anything about local history, about how Ossining had been involved in American history, how the Hudson River had been involved. So I remember walking to school on a trail for about three blocks before I got from my house, which was across the street from the famous Sing Sing prison, where my dad also worked part-time in the bakery. It turned out that was the Old Croton Aqueduct, which was one of the first major aqueducts to be built in the United States to bring water to the metropolis of New York, which was then booming in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, etc. So I went through kind of a traditional school system in Ossining, and then I went off to Ithaca College and changed my major three or four times. I majored in music, I majored in business, and then I majored in just liberal arts and with a minor in history, not knowing what I was going to do. Graduated from Ithaca College, came back to Ossining, was looking for a job in broadcasting. Did get a few offers, but they were far away, far away. They were in Jersey and they were in Massachusetts, and we had, my Joanne and I had just gotten married, and we had a little baby. So one day I went down to the Ossining Middle School and asked the principal if he needed any help with substitute teachers, because I figured I'd need to make a few dollars because we were then living with my parents. And he said, sure, I can always use substitutes. Did you graduate from college? And I said, yes. He never asked me about grade average or anything like that. So I started subbing in the middle school, and I subbed math, I subbed science, I subbed social studies, I subbed gym. And I worked for about three or four months. And then, lo and behold, one of the social studies teachers was leaving to go to California. I think her husband was doing graduate work at Stanford. And so she was moving, and the principal said, would you like a job? So I said, yeah, sure. If it brings in some money and pays the bills, never really thinking that I would become a teacher. Yeah. And I hadn't really trained to do that. Anyway, I took the job. I worked at the middle school I started in English, then switched to social studies, and that was kind of the beginning. But for me, my first few years of teaching were very frustrating because I was teaching my seventh and eighth graders the same way that I had been taught, which was read the textbook, take the textbook home and do the questions, answer the questions in class the following day, have a test on Friday, and that's the way you taught history. And this was now in the 60s. The next thing that happened was I moved to the new middle school that had just been built and started, was now in the social studies department, taught the traditional way for three or four years. And then just as a stroke of luck, the 70s came along and everything was changing in the United States.
Yeah, right.
It was the whole love thing and the hippies and the, and everything was changing. And I think there were teachers, young teachers like myself, who were beginning to question what American education was all about, that the earlier generation that I was really a part of, the way we had been taught was kind of okay, but it didn't have any fire, it didn't have any energy. And in history, I never felt when I was, even at Ithaca College, I had a couple of good teachers.
Yeah.
They were pretty good, but I never felt history. I never felt like I was touching it. I didn't really feel it. There was no excitement. Okay, it was interesting, but it just didn't go beyond that. And so in the early 70s, this revolution began to take place in our country. And it, for me, it was pure luck, just that I happened to be ready to make a change, to listen to other choices and other approaches to educating students. And it, you know, there I was. I even went home one day, we had three children now, and said to my wife, Joanne, who had been trained to be an elementary school teacher but really wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, Joanne, I think I have to quit my job and go to law school. She said, what are you kidding? Well, how are we going to live? You can't go to law school. You have to stay in the classroom. So I went back to the classroom, and I was a little disillusioned. But then all of a sudden, one day, I picked up the New York Times, which I got in school back then. I picked up the New York Times, and the first section of the Times, way back towards the editorial page, there was a tiny story about a professor of history at Stony Brook, SUNY Stony Brook in Long Island. And she was doing something with her college students and graduate students. They had a picture. And the students were in a graveyard. They weren't in a classroom, in a building. They were in a graveyard. And it was out in Long Island. And her name was Gaynell Levine. And it talked about how she was taking her classroom into a colonial graveyard. Well, when I saw that, I thought, this woman's crazy. What the heck is she doing? So I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to write a letter. There was no internet or anything like that. I had a phone number. So I wrote a letter to SUNY Stony Brook, attention professor Gaynell Levine, and I got a letter back. And Professor Levine said, Carl, come on down to Stony Brook. Well, I didn't know where Stony Brook was. I didn't even know where Long Island was. So I went to my principal. I said, could I take a personal day? And he said, where are you going? I said, Stony Brook. And he said, where is that? He said, what the heck are you going to do in Stony Brook? I said, I'm not sure. But there's a teacher down there that's doing something that sounds interesting. It sounds different. And it sounds kind of exciting. And I wonder if kids can learn that way. By leaving the building, which was unheard of in those days. You may have done one field trip a year. You went to the Museum of Natural History, you know, and that was it. But there was no such thing as field trips in the community or anything like that. So I went. I took a day off. Well, I got a personal day. I went down to Stony Brook. I met Professor Levine. She took me out into the graveyard, and boy, Long Island has great gravestones. Some of them were Johann Zuricher, who was one of the first Dutch gravestone recorders. The work was beautiful, and they were wrapping the stones, and these were, again, college kids.
Yeah.
They were wrapping the stones with rice paper, I don't know, and waxing, and they were making, they were taking aluminum foil and making plaster of Paris images, and you know, and I'm there with my tongue hanging out, like, what the heck is happening here?
Right.
But the thing I noticed was two things: that Professor Levine was into it, she was excited, and she was learning with the students, because this was something that she was also experimenting with.
Right.
And the other thing I noticed was that the students were having a really good time. It was hands-on. They even brought a picnic basket, so we sat in the middle of the graveyard for about an hour and just chatted about what they were doing, etc. And the extension was that the kids were not only doing this kind of from an artistic point of view, but then they had to go and do research on the the people who were interred in the colonial graveyard to see if they could find something about their history and maybe were there any relatives. And so their search would take them to the county archives. Mm-hmm. The search would take them to the planning board or the local tax authorities to see if there were, you know, where these people might have lived, et cetera. So the project, from what Gaynell said, was the project was starting to grow, and each year it was growing, and she wasn't sure in which direction she was going, but I loved that part of it. So I said to her, Professor, do you think I could take this back to Westchester County and do this with my seventh graders? And she said, of course you can do it with the seventh graders. So I came back, and for the first time in my career, I thought, I don't have to use a textbook. I don't have to give tests all the time. Yeah. And maybe the kids can learn history a different way, using a different style, using a different method. And if I'm excited about it, if I'm interested in it, and I just say to the kids, look, it's an experiment. Let's go out and try it and see if we like it. And I'll let you feedback to me. Tell me what you think about it, and how can I change this to make it more interesting for the class coming in next year. And of course, here in Austin, I had a wonderful Sparta Cemetery, and I had the old Dutch church in Tarrytown.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. The Phillips family and the Van Cortlandts up here in Croton at the Bethel Cemetery. So I had classrooms that I could use if they were available. And as it turned out, they were available.
Yeah.
And so I went to my principal, I went to my department chair and said, look, I'd like to take the kids on a field trip. It's going to be right in the community. You know, we're going to walk there. Mm-hmm. I don't need buses or anything. Mm-hmm. And they said, absolutely not. You know, insurance, this and everything, you've got to be, you should, in 2 weeks, you should be on page 275 in your New York State textbook. And, you know, I really started to scratch my head. Like, wait a minute, guys, can we talk about this?
Yeah, right.
And no one seemed to really understand. And I think they saw this as a weird threat of some kind. And my principal, nice lady, had no clue. Former nun, ran the school with a tight ship. Everything had to be in line. Everyone had to be on the same page. And she was against it. Okay, so I thought, what am I going to do? And then my wife said to me, well, if you can't do it during school days, start doing it on a Saturday or a Sunday. Just have the kids volunteer to come. Start with 10 kids and ask the classes.
Right.
And Professor Levine had given me some great slides that I threw up on the screen in my classroom, with color slides of these stones in Long Island. And then I went down to Sleepy Hollow and down to Sparta, took some photographs myself, put those up and said to the kids, okay, Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, bring your parents, okay, bring a sandwich, and I'll bring all the supplies. And I had bought the supplies myself. And so my backyard history program, which it eventually became known as, started with Gaynell Levine.
And with administrative roadblocks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. But what I figured out very quickly was in my first class, one of the mothers of one of my daughters was on the school board. So she came to one of my early classes in the graveyard and loved it. In fact, even ended up doing the recording herself. And then said to me on the way home, Mr. O, if you need any support on this, I'm on the board, and come to us and, you know, just mention to, which I did. And I took some of the kids and some of the parents came with me. So that's the first thing that I learned is get to the board and get to the people who are influential. And if your principal isn't helpful, just maybe just in a very professional way, just go kind of around it. And the second thing I learned from Professor Levine was have local media. Get a reporter, get a photographer, and have them come on one of your walks or one of your rubbings or whatever you're doing with the kids, and have them documented and get it into your local newspaper. Because not only what it does is it makes the community look good, it makes the school look good, and of course it makes me look, and it acts as a kind of an insulation in a way.
Right.
Okay. So that's kind of the way my backyard history things started. And then I continued to look around for other educators in the metropolitan area that I thought might be doing. So I went to some conferences. I did a few myself where I did a workshop and met other teachers who came, you know, come up to you afterwards and go, "Oh, Carl, I love what you're doing with your classes. And by the way, in Passaic, New Jersey," what? "In Passaic, New Jersey, I'm teaching seventh graders in downtown Passaic," which is not a great place.
Yeah, right.
"But we have some really old federal colonial brownstones that are falling apart. But the architecture on these buildings, in some of these neighborhoods, you know, they're not in great shape. But if you have a little bit of a vision, you can see that these buildings at one time had a history. And that people lived there, and there may have been stores there, and there may have been a synagogue or a church around the corner that's in disuse now, or may have just been torn down." So I said, "Well, what are you doing?"
Yeah.
And this guy, Ray, said, I have a project that the 7th and 8th graders are working on, and it's called Adopt a Building." I said, "Well, what does that mean?" The kids have to, we go on a walking tour of downtown, and the kids have to pick out a building. And it could be their own house if they want.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But one of the applications was that the house has to be at least 50 years old. And they adopt the building. And they research the history of the building. They research the architecture. They find out if there's any people still living in the building.
Right.
Or working in the building. Or know anything about the building. They interview neighbors. Yes. And they use all of the government agencies to do research, to do titles for title searches, for surveys, for whatever. And now you're teaching government stuff too, you know. So it just kind of reaches out. And Ray said, "I have my art department working with me on this." And I thought, whoa!
Yeah.
And the science department and the music department, we're kind of doing a general. This is a project where, you know, we're getting most of the other academia involved in, and some of them are excited about this, others are resistant to it. But, and I thought, wow, could I do that in Austin? Could I do an adopt a building kind of thing in Austin? So one Saturday I went down, I walked the streets downtown, and I thought, oh my God, of course.
Yeah, right.
We're loaded. And they're in pretty good shape.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yeah.
This is not, we're not living in it's not
right.
Real decay.
Yeah.
So we've got a classroom here. So David, over a period of years, I put together a series involving team teachers, involving myself, and I think most important, you know, if you ask the question, what makes a good teacher and what makes good teaching?
Sure, yeah.
I think the first thing is that the teacher has to be excited about what they're teaching.
Yeah.
And know what they're teaching, grow with their teaching, and not be afraid to make mistakes, to allow the students to feed back. Because every year after, you know, the last few days of school every year, I would say to the kids, okay, shoot me down. You know, what worked this year? And what did you think was really not worth much? I mean, you know, that project we did on the colonial newspaper, you know, it was boring, Mr. O. And I would evaluate that and try to be very professional about it. And sometimes it hurt because there were kids that kind of would nail you, you know, and say, not much work this year for me, you know. I just felt lost. And when I was in these groups, I was always with kids that were a lot smarter than me, and I just felt uncomfortable. So, you know, I'd go back to the drawing board and try to figure out what's going on. But I think, you know, having intelligent, creative teachers, having teachers who not only care about kids, but care about their curriculum. And I guess for me, I feel very strongly as an American citizen that, you know, when I read about people putting money outside of this country, on islands, or in Switzerland, I don't even begin to get that. Because I believe that I owe this nation an awful lot for living here, for being here. I feel that I want to pay my taxes. I have to pay my taxes. I'm responsible for that. And I feel a very strong sense of community. I think that in my way, I have to find a way to support my community, to help my... So I think giving to your nation and giving to your community is very important. And I think everyone has to kind of find their niche. And mine just happened to be local history. So I've just kind of evolved into that. I had no intent. I mean, if you asked me, were you thinking about this when you were 18, 19 years old? The answer is absolutely not. So I just kind of became.
We're chatting with Carl Ochsner, mentor, friend, teacher, leader, innovator. We could go on down the accolades on KZSU FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU FM, Stanford, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to keep listening. So Carl, you've spoken about the work you did outside the class, the traditional classroom. But I want to talk about your traditional classroom for a moment, because this traditional classroom that you had also wasn't so traditional. Now, I'm going to try to paint a verbal picture of this space. On Hearsay Culture, I've had on from time to time people that talk about spaces for speech, spaces for learning, spaces for all kinds of activities, and even architects. And I want to describe your space and really give you an opportunity to talk about your thinking behind this space. So I'm going to start by saying this, and correct me if I'm wrong, that your classroom at the Ann M. Daughter Middle School was one where you had to have at least some kind of variance from the fire marshal in order to do, yes, and I'm getting a thumbs up here, ladies and gentlemen, so I got that right. Because, why? It's not because Carl was lighting fires in the room, literally, although certainly figuratively with students, but the room was covered, literally ceiling to the floor, with newspaper clippings, magazine clippings, about local history or anything else that was significant. In addition, the room was also, and this is a nice but a traditional classroom space in a public school. So it's a room with a wall of windows. There are desks. They're all movable, right? But it's a standard room. Not only was the floor and literally up from the wall through the ceiling covered, right? I want to paint this image for the listeners, but also you had around the room what certainly in New York we call tchotchkes, right? But really were artifacts, right, of local history, bottles, right, pieces of mantles and all this other stuff around the room, which painted, and to be clear, there were also books, right? There were also, you know, chairs, but what you had was a room full of, now I might say information, right? But we could also describe it other ways. So I'm painting this picture, and this is like I've not seen any other classroom like it. The closest equivalent to what I've seen today would be something like a kindergarten or first grade room, to the extent that there's lots of colorful things on a wall. But when I say that there was no open wall space, I believe I'm right about that. So with that image, and maybe I don't know if you have a picture, but if you have a picture of your classroom from back, maybe you could send it to me.
I do.
And so maybe I'll post that when we post the show. But I want to stop there. What was your idea and thinking, and perhaps it's related to your teaching outside the classroom, in creating that space? Why was it important to you as a teacher, and what did you seek to convey to the students?
Well, I think the first thing was that when I was growing up, going through the school system, including college, my American my colonial history class at Austin High School was taught by this sweet older teacher who had her hair back in a bun, and everyone called her George Washington because she looked like George Washington. And all the, back then, David, all the desks were screwed into the floor,
so you couldn't
move a desk.
Right.
And the only extra piece of anything in the room besides the blackboard was a map of the United States. But that was rolled up, and it was up above her head, and her desk was in the middle. And maybe once every 2 weeks, she would pull the map down, point to Rhode Island, and then the map would go back up, right? So that was as far. And the windows, I mean, looked out on the Hudson River, because the school was, what, 3 stories? So you had a view of, in fact, you could see Croton Point from where I sat in her class. And she taught colonial history in that room. And I never knew that just by looking out that window, I could see Croton Point. And on the other side of Croton Point was Haverstraw Bay. And Haverstraw Bay is where Benedict Arnold met Major John Andre. And the whole thing with West Point occurred and could have changed the entire direction of the of what we now know as the United States of America. But all I knew was that there was a rolled up map and she had hair that looked like George Washington. So nothing happened in that class. A nice look, a very pleasant lady. But nothing ever happened. And I think subconsciously, I said to myself, if I ever, in any way, form of expression, if I ever have a home, yeah, or if I ever have a classroom, if I ever get into education, it's got to be a place where when the door opens and the kids walk in, their eyes have to open and they've got to begin looking and they've got to begin wondering. And I know when I first started teaching the old way with the textbook and the test, et cetera, I didn't have anything up on my walls because no one had anything up on the walls. Yeah. And the kids would come in, and I remember looking at their eyes, and their eyes were like glass. They were cloudy.
Yeah.
And when they left my class, they were cloudy. Yeah. And they used to look at their little watches, you know, when is the bell going to ring so we can get out of here? And I was sensitive enough to notice that, and I realized, you know, the environment in which I teach has to be brighter and more accepting and more exciting. And certainly it has to be that way for them. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. So I slowly, and I, of course, spoke to my wife, Joanne, who is an artist, and said, visually, Carl, you got to get some stuff. And she even gave me some of her paintings in the beginning. And I just put them along the shelves, et cetera, just to kind of brighten. Kids would ask, what's that, Mr. O? What's that? Who did that? Et cetera. So slowly I began to, and then by going out into the community, Dave, kids were finding stuff. Right. I was finding stuff. We were digging bottles. We were going out to Croton Point and getting oyster shells. And so whenever kids would bring, and I would always say to my classes, look, once a week there's trash collection, not garbage, but trash. So I want you to walk around your neighborhood. You don't have to do it every week, but once a month, walk around the neighborhood on trash day. See what people throw out. And if there's anything that looks even vaguely interesting, it's there. You don't have to bring in a table, but bring in trivia. Just bring in local backyard stuff.
Right.
And stuff began to come in. And I would even say, and then I would show the rest of the class, you know, this is what Jamie brought in. And then we're going to put it on the back table so that everyone can see it. So over a period of time, and I went, one of the things that stands out, I was a part-time musician, and one of the instruments I played was the sousaphone. And I marched in some local bands, and I played in a couple of Dixieland bands for a little while. I had a sousaphone. Don't do it anymore. But so I'm a sousaphone buff. And one day, one of my little girls who lived on Hunter Street, all the way down by the prison, brought in a box, and in the box there were some envelopes. And I looked at them. There were family photographs of an African-American family that they didn't seem to be terribly interesting. I didn't know who they were. But then there was a tiny brownish envelope, and I opened the envelope and out spilled 6 small black and white photographs. And when I looked at them, I thought, wait a minute. This is the First Baptist Church on the Albany Post Drive, right in the middle of our village. There's the church steeple. And who are these people gathered in the on the front lawn of the church? Well, they have Navy uniforms on, United States Navy uniforms. And they've got instruments. It's a band. It's a band. And it's Ossining. And those uniforms look like First World War, maybe?
Yeah.
I mean, they're old. Yeah. Not civil.
Yeah.
But somewhere. Oh, look at this photograph. It shows downtown Ossining with a banner hung across Lower Main Street. And the banner says, "Welcome home to our troops."
Wow.
And the soldier that was painted on the banner was World War I. So I thought it had to be, what, 1917, 18?
Right.
In that time period? So was the band connected to where the soldiers coming home? Was there a parade? And where what was this Navy band? And then I looked at the next photograph, and there were three Navy officers standing on Highland Avenue in front of the First Baptist Church. And I looked at them, and the guy in the middle, it struck me like a bolt. You know who it was? John Philip Sousa.
Wow.
The American March King.
Wow.
And I thought, whoa! Yeah. Sousa was in Ossining
right.
in 1917, 18.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
What was he doing in Ossining?
Yeah.
Was he on his way to the city? And the Navy band? I know he was involved in the Marine band in Washington. I asked around. I asked one of our music teachers, and he said, well, you know, before he went to Washington to do the Marine band, the President's band, he was in charge of the Great Lakes Navy Station out, you know, in Michigan, Minnesota area. He was out there, and he traveled with that band from time to time.
Hmm.
And I thought, ha!
Yeah.
All right? So...
Amazing.
I did a little research, and then I went to a local framer, and I had them put in a frame because I thought, these are just too precious.
Yeah, right.
And went back and showed the kids and said, you know, my classes, look, the band king of the United States was here in Ossining. What a great piece of local history that is.
Right.
Okay. Et cetera. By the way, I have since been in touch with the Sousa Archives.
Yeah, I'm about to say, what did you, did you find
Sousa,
out more?
Yeah. No, yeah, I found out some more. They really couldn't help me.
Huh.
They said it was suit because I scanned everything and sent it out to them.
Yeah.
They're at the Champaign-Urbana at the university. They're on the campus. They have a small museum there. And I still want to take that thing out there at some point and let them look at that. So anyway, so, you know, that was the kind of stuff that was happening all the time. Kids were bringing stuff in and kids were beginning to search and look, et cetera. So those were the kinds of things that whenever they came in, I put them, you know, I put them on the wall, I put them on the shelves, et cetera. And yes, the fire marshals did come in every June and I did get complaints. But I think about 3 or 4 years after that, one of the fire marshals, I had his daughter in my
class.
I'm
about to say, eventually had to come around.
So there were fewer complaints about the classroom.
Well, it definitely had that influence on me, Carl. I mean, as I, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, it is without question the case that I would not have gone to law school or had the inspiration to become an attorney without your influence. And being in that room did create that kind of energy, which I guess leads me to a question is, you know, and we're getting to the point of the show, by the way, where I start doing what I call the unfair portion of the show. And that's when I started.
I'm ready. I'm ready.
Yeah. This is, and it's unfair only because of, speaking of space, now we'll talk about time because of time left on the show. We still have a good 15 minutes. So we're okay. But let me fast forward to one issue, which is very, very much in the news and very much related to what you're talking about to get your perspective on it, which is online education, right? We, you know, there is a push, as you know, in all levels of education, higher ed on down, law schools, to teach online, right? To use the power of technology and the internet to reach, you know, huge audiences, right? The massive online courses, right? MOOCs. And it strikes me, as you've described how you teach and how you taught, that online education could perhaps be an impediment, or it could be something that might augment. So I'm curious to get your perspective on this. I mean, as we conceive online education today, right? The idea of the teacher not being physically in the same space, right, as the students, but connected through technology, where you have the ability
to interact at some levels, but not in every level, right? On the other hand, you reach a wider audience, right? And of course, the barriers to getting access to education are diminished. What's your take on online education today? And I don't mean, I don't want a judgment necessarily unless you want to offer one, but really your perspective on whether you see it as a positive development, as a negative development, as something we should look more at or not, or just any thoughts about it. Any and I recognize, of course, and the last thing I'll say is by way of preface, which is that the world that I grew up in as your student in the 80s, the world that in fact we were in really even 5 years ago with regard to online education is very different than now. So, you know, as we're chatting on June 20, 2014, any thoughts about online ed?
I, you know, my vote on it is still, you know, I'm still a little confused by it, but I think the concept of reaching more students is certainly a good thing, mm-hmm. because the more we educate, the more our nation grows, and it's certainly better to have an intelligent populace mm-hmm. that's involved in the structure of our country. Mm-hmm. I somehow see the internet classes, the online classes, as an extension of what I had when I was a kid. I don't see the feel there. I don't see the touching there. You know, as I was telling you before we did the program this morning, the little kids in my neighborhood now are all techies. They're techies. And on one hand, I think it's terrific to see them with their little fingers. They're texting and they're looking and they're checking all this stuff. But I can't say hello to any of them at the bottom of my driveway anymore because they look at me funny. They don't know how to socialize with me. They don't know how to connect with me. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because I'm an older person. Mm-hmm. And I don't see... See, and whenever I do walks now, David, mm-hmm. you know, where I'm still doing the same stuff, but I'm doing it with adults now.
Yeah.
I never, ever get a young family with kids. Mm-hmm. I never get any high school kids to come out and walk for 2 hours and look at mm-hmm. history and touch history and listen to history and kind of get engaged in real history. That's just not something that is done anymore. And that's frustrating for me, and I don't know how to deal with that. But I think I think there's a place mm-hmm. for online education, and I think it's good for the masses, but I'm still kind of the old traditionalist. I still feel like I'm doing a walk on Sunday and mm-hmm. you know, I've been trying to figure out what am I going to let them touch and where am I going to let them walk so that we can really engage in some of the architecture, some of the engineering projects that I'm going to show them in downtown Austin, mostly the old Croton Aqueduct. So I think, you know, my vote is still hanging on the technology. I mean, I have my wonderful Apple computer in my office, and I work on it 2 or 3 hours a day. I'm still writing, and I still use the internet, and I love the fact that I can now research anything and research everything, and that museums and archives and libraries, everything's being digitized and put up there. So now I can go to all of these museums and access, especially at the photographs, are just incredible. I have, you know, I have 14,000 photographs in my iPhoto now, and they're mostly of historical nature. Yeah. And if I want, you know, if I want a different view of I go to the New York City Public Library, or I go to this museum, I go to that museum, and I'm beginning to learn more of how that works. So it's certainly expanding and changing, but it also makes me nervous because I think we're losing something in the technology, and I'm not quite sure, you know, I'm not quite sure what it is.
Well, that, you know, and that's the struggle, I think, that you know, that we face today, which is drawing that balance. And so I want to ask you, Carl, and you know, it certainly in a few minutes about your current work and your friends organization that is wonderful. And so let me ask this follow-up question before we get there. So one of the concepts that is related to this, right, is this issue, and you've alluded to it, is this issue of attention, right? The economics of attention, as Richard Lanham and others have written about, the notion that as human beings, there's only so much that we can take in.
Exactly.
And I think that that has a lot of currency, which is what I wanted to tie to your style of teaching. Right, the influence that, and I want to be clear, I know, and I recognize that this interview, like I said, is different than other interviews, in that I'm offering, what sound like platitudes. They are heartfelt, and as I mentioned, are important to this discussion because, among other things, and now having being a teacher myself, receiving this kind of feedback, I have found to be personally incredibly rewarding and valuable. As much as I love the radio show, which I consider as an extension of pedagogy, mm-hmm. And advocacy and writing, it is feedback from students that I have found to be incredibly rewarding because it tells me that I can have an impact, and I enjoy, as you do, in seeing people be successful. The technological angle that we have here on attention seems very important mm-hmm. to me. Because as busy as we are, right, as I'm sitting here, and again, we're talking with Carl Ochsner on KZSM from Stanford. I've got the recording device in front of me. I've also got an iPad. I've also got an iPhone. And as you mentioned, they are devices, but they are distractors. And so my question is this. As a teacher of X number of years, right, of decades, right, who is not adverse to technology, clearly.
Not at all.
Right, but also has reservations about how it could be used. And this is a tough one. If you were integrating technology, and I mean, right, the iPad, put aside the iPhone, which let's focus on an iPad, right, or just a computer, into your classroom today, how would you begin to do that? How would you work a computer, right, into your room to achieve the goals that you laid out very well early on, right? So in other words, and I want to put you in a box simply to say that you have to put it in there, right? As opposed to saying, well, I'm not going to, which might be a legitimate thing to do as well. But let's focus on if you were to do it. Any thoughts on how you would today? What would you do with that device to augment your goals and your style of teaching for the students?
I would use it as a research tool. Mm-hmm. I would use it like I used to send the kids to the school library. Mm-hmm. Or to the public library. Mm-hmm. I would limit it to that. Mm-hmm. I think I would insist that the classroom be open discussion with the students, and I would be working in groups. I think group work is terrific. Mm-hmm. I struggled with it for a few years, but I found, and it became kind of I got to the point where I was grading students on a portfolio basis, mm-hmm. which I think really worked for me very well. But today I would say the kids would have their laptop in class. Mm-hmm. I would not have any problems with that. Maybe if they wanted to take notes on something that I was kind of lecturing about or covering background material for a project that they were doing or something like that, I wouldn't be adverse to that. And I would insist that they use it as a research tool like I'm using now in my office here, mm-hmm. At home. But, I don't know. What other ways would I limit it?
If I change the question slightly, I'm curious about this. Would you take the option of saying, despite all of its benefits, I don't want the computer in my classroom? Is that something you think you would? No. Okay.
I am finding it.
Yeah. Okay.
I find now with my research, because I'm now researching local historical topics, mm-hmm. for not only walks that I'm doing, for programs where I'm still lecturing that I do at local libraries and historical societies, mm-hmm. and for our Croton Friends, a group that I started, Croton Friends of History. We have a really nice website. I have a great webmaster that's doing creative stuff for me, and so I'm writing for them also. So I see its value, mm-hmm. but I just would be afraid, as being a teacher in the classroom, that the kids would just be using their computers all the time, and I would become a computer teacher, or I would become a technology supporter, et cetera, even though I would want to help them with their research. Mm-hmm. But I would see it as an additional important tool to research historical background information, mm-hmm. in my classroom. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, I still think there has to be the student-teacher relationship, and we have to be able to talk to each other, and kids have to ask questions, etc. That human element, which I think is so important. And I always tried to pride myself on getting to know my students, meet them at the door every day, say goodbye to them. We even had our little clap. I don't know if you remember.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
One, two, three, clap. Yeah. One, two, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Just to bring us together as a group. And I think that's still, you know, very important. And when I see the kids out here on the street and totally tuned out from, you know, and sometimes I feel like they're in their little world here because they really don't want to be in that outside mm-hmm. world. They don't want to see other people. They don't want to have to say hello to an older guy who lives in the neighborhood. That scares the hell out of them. They don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
So they text, they text, they text, they text, you know, and that's kind of the way their world is. And that scares me because I think that human element, the element of the social graces, being able to communicate with people on a one-to-one basis and know what to say and what not to say is, I don't know, I just feel like we're kind of losing that. I see it in my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Do you? Yeah.
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 Yeah, and I'll tell you, I mean, as a, you know, as aside from teaching in this area, but as the father of two boys.
How old are your two boys?
So Noah is 7 and Benjamin's 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you that I have resisted mightily even giving them access to an iPad for educational purposes.
Yes.
I am certainly not. I'm not avoiding the issue, and they do work with it from time to time, but I am encouraging my sons, despite everything at this point in their lives, to be exactly what you're describing, working with their hands, touching, feeling, building, even though take something like Minecraft, right? This very popular game, which has many educational aspects to it and really is a fascinating game. I'd rather have them work physically with Legos.
Yes.
At this point, which leads to, and again, I mean, this is, as I said, unfair portion of the show. I would be remiss in not asking you about what you're doing now, because as you mentioned, you are not sitting in a rocking chair, right? It's quite the opposite. And not that you're at the age where we're necessarily sitting there, and not that sitting in a rocking chair is so bad.
No.
But let's talk for a few minutes here. The organization that I believe you founded here in Croton, New York, and what you're doing with it now.
Well, when I left the Austin schools, I really don't use the word retired. I just changed direction.
I loaded that term. No. Yes. Yeah.
I joined the Croton Historical Society because I've lived here. The kids grew up here, but I really had never been a part of that organization. I was always deeply involved with the Austin because I was teaching there. And so I went to them and offered my expertise, and they were not happy that I was coming because I made suggestions like we do projects, we publish a book, we go to other historical societies and engage them and maybe have common programs and exchange. Well, they didn't like that. They wanted to meet Monday morning, have coffee and donuts, and talk about the old fire department in 1925, what a great parade they had and how their ancestors had been there and how they grew up. So I left, and I got about 10 people in the local community who I thought were sensitive to what I was trying to do. And we formed, right here in this room, the Croton Friends of History. And we are now, we have a charter from the Department of Education in Albany. We're nonprofit, et cetera. We do programs each month at the library. We have a website. Thankfully, we do not have a building that we have to worry about.
There we go. Yeah.
So whatever money we get, we're digitizing our collection of stuff that we have. I just got an email from a teacher in the Croton schools who said to me that he just moved into an old brownstone in downtown Peekskill, and he took down the ceiling to repair it because it's an old building. And what fell out of the ceiling but a box of old photographs?
Wow.
And he said to me, Carl, we have to have breakfast soon because I want to give you this box so you can look through the photographs so that you can scan them and add them to your collection and put them. We're on Facebook. We have 1,100 people now on our Facebook page. Facebook, I love, but it scares me a little too because I think it's a little out of control.
Yes.
And I'm not sure because you're the you're the professor. You're, you know, some of the stuff I see on Facebook, I wonder if freedom of speech and everything. I mean, where does that all fit? Okay,
right.
But I know we're going to straighten that out.
Yeah, eventually.
Carl, as I said,
David, can I say one more thing?
Of course, please. No, go ahead.
Just
yes,
again,
yes.
I am. I just want the audience to know this is one heck of a human being here. When I think back to having him in the 7th and 8th grade, and how easy he made it for me to teach, because he brought with him an incredible set of values that his parents and ancestors had given him. His thirst for learning, his willingness to listen and to change. It was just always a pleasure. I driving to school every day, David was the kind of student that you looked forward to having in your classroom. And it just made my job an awful lot easier. And again, let me just say, I'm so proud. And keep doing the work you're doing and keep your attitude up. And you're so full of energy. And it's just really been a pleasure to be here with you today.
And Carl, as you know, thank you. And of course, I'm sitting across from the role model for that. And again, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I'm comfortable almost saying this, you know, thanks on behalf of so many students who came through the Austin Public Schools while you were there, because I'm far from the only person that feels this way, for your dedication and your selflessness and the time that you put into it. The impact that you had as a teacher has been remarkable. And like I said, to be clear, I would not be doing this today, but for your influence.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate that very, very much.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests coming up on the show this quarter. We're recording the show on June 20th, and our quarter will begin in July. There's a range of guests that we have coming on. Authors like David Zweig, writing, in fact, on issues involving attention. Mariaki Shaki, a Dutch member of parliament who focuses on e-democracy and technology. Fred Schauer, the former dean from the Kennedy School at Harvard, who'll be talking on the right to information. David Shanzer from Duke University, focusing on Edward Snowden and the revelations coming out of government, and many other wonderful guests, including, and now that I think about it, because I am doing this from memory right now, Victoria Stodden, who's been on the show previously, who along with several other co-authors, is writing on big data and how it might be used today. As always, you have a number of ways to listen, and I'll be posting that schedule, incidentally, in the beginning of July. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to KZSU. You can, of course, stream it at kzsulive.stanford.edu. I do not, as I'm sitting here now, know what time the show will be airing during the week on KZSU's schedule, but by the time this is on the air, streaming live, you'll know what time it is. But you can also listen to the show via podcast by going to either the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. You can go to hearsayculture.com, or you can go to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society, where you can not only get all 200-plus previous shows of Hearsay Culture, but upcoming guests and speakers at CIS as well as Hearsay Culture. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining today on KZSU. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.